This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hitler never planned to exterminate the Jews. Jews were not gassed in Auschwitz. There was no Holocaust. The Holocaust is a hoax dreamed up by the Jews to get money and sympathy for the State of Israel. Well, those statements are transparently untrue, and yet there's a growing movement of people who believe them and are trying to rewrite history by saying the Holocaust never happened. My guest Deborah Lipstadt says their pseudo-scholarship is a threat not just to Jewish history, but to all who believe in the ultimate power of reason. In her new book, Denying the Holocaust, she examines the workings of the Holocaust denial movement and its assault on truth and memory. Lipstadt is a professor of modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University. She told me that she started taking the Holocaust deniers seriously when she saw they had made inroads onto college campuses.
They prepared an ad questioning the veracity of the Holocaust, saying that the Holocaust didn't happen, and accusing the political correctness police of preventing students from really learning that the Holocaust didn't happen, claiming that you can question everything on campus, but you can't question the veracity of the Holocaust. They went and then distributed or submitted that ad to a number of universities and university school newspapers, student newspapers, and the student newspapers accepted it and ran it in many cases. And the thing to know is that we're not talking about no place university, or we're talking about major schools and important schools, Michigan, Cornell, Duke, Ohio State, University of Georgia. And these schools, in most cases, accepted the ad and ran the ad. In certain cases, it engendered a tremendous debate on campus as to whether they should or should not. And when I saw the way the students responded, it concerned me deeply.
Well, did some people believe the ad?
Well, it wasn't even that they believed it, but one of the responses was, of course, the First Amendment argument, that these people have a First Amendment right to run their ads in the newspaper or even have op-ed pieces in the newspaper. And my argument was that this isn't a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment says that the government can't have any interference in the freedom of anyone you want to put on the air or newspaper wants to put in there on their pages. So for them to claim freedom of press was a sort of murky issue or a questionable issue, on top of which each of these newspapers that ran the ad have pretty strict advertising codes, far stricter than most commercial newspapers. They won't accept X-rated movies. Some don't even accept cigarette ads. So that was one response, and I thought that was a misunderstanding of the Constitution. But what disturbed me far more were two other responses. One response which said, well, yes, we do. When the students on campus, both Jewish and non-Jewish, who protested against the ad, said you wouldn't run an ad that was racist or that was sexist, some of the editors responded, well, this ad is not anti-Semitic. We looked at this ad carefully. The inability to recognize this as anti-Semitism, straight-out anti-Semitism. But most disturbing to me, and I guess this is really when the antennae, you know, my light bulb over my head went off, when the students began to talk about this as an opinion. This is someone's point of view. Northwestern University, they described an unorthodox view of the Holocaust, that these ideas have a right to be heard out there. And I think the Harvard Crimson had it best when they said it's just garbage. And the students couldn't recognize it for the nonsense that it was.
Is there any evidence that the Holocaust denial movement has made any inroads into the mainstream of American thought?
Well, recently there was a Roper poll on this very question, and the Roper organization asked people, is it possible that the Holocaust didn't happen? And 20% of Americans and 22% of high school students said, yes, it was possible. Now, I recognize that if you were to ask Americans, is it possible that John F. Kennedy is alive and well and living in the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, some would say, yes, it's possible. Or is it possible that Elvis is, you know, living in the Liberty Bell? They might say, yes, it's possible. Americans, you know, there's always going to be a small core that's going to be willing to consider any notion. But even when you factor that out, that response is a response that's disturbing.
Well, as you say in your book, you're studying this to try to understand the fragility of reason and society's susceptibility to far-fetched ideas. So you see this as a case study in our susceptibility to far-fetched ideas.
Absolutely. This is not, I did not write this book solely about the attack on the Holocaust or the attack on an aspect of Jewish history, which is, of course, something that concerned me. But I am really concerned if this history is not safe, then no history is safe. If this memory is not safe, no memory is safe. And with the ferment in the world right now, history is up for grabs.
Now, you're often invited onto TV talk shows to debate people from the Holocaust denial movement, and you refuse to debate them. Why?
Categorically, I refuse. And it amazes some people because here I have a new book coming out, and any author wants every bit of PR and any vehicle to promote their book. But I have refused at least four or five national TV shows and numerous local shows and radio shows. I won't debate people who are liars. I will debate someone who wants to argue that, Hitler, the orders came from Hitler, or they came from subordinates up, you know, the idea for the Holocaust came from the bottom, came from the top. I will debate someone who thinks the Holocaust is unique in terms of its barbarity, or and someone who doesn't. Lots of things to debate and lots of differences to discuss here. But I can't debate people who are outright liars, who have no fidelity to the truth, who will just say this didn't happen or this happened or there are no documents, et cetera, et cetera. There's no room for debate there. And I won't give them the credibility of being the other side. See, that's what they want. That's their agenda. That's exactly what they wanted to do on campus. They want to be thought of at this point as the other side of a debate. And that's why they call themselves revisionists. I don't use that term because they're not revising anything. They're denying. But they want to be thought of as simply people exploring the truth. That's how they wrap themselves in this cloak of truth. And the truth is that they're exactly the opposite.
Let's look at the history of the Holocaust denial movement. You trace it to after the war in France, where it really starts seriously. What are the first signs of it after the war in France?
Well, you begin to get a number of Frenchmen who begin to say that the stories are exaggerated, that this can't quite be true, that we don't know if it's precisely as it happened. But in those early years, you're yet to have people saying the gas chambers didn't happen, to say it's an outright hoax, it's an outright fraud. That begins to happen actually in part in France and then picked up very quickly in the United States shortly thereafter. So you've had people trying to deny this from the 1950s, most of them from the extreme, extreme right, political right wing. And they have not only a anti-Semitic, but also a white supremacist agenda.
Well, one of the early people in the United States that said the Holocaust has been exaggerated was George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party. Now, I guess it was easy for Americans to dismiss him because, I mean, everybody knows that he's an extremist. Everybody knows he's anti-Semitic. But did then people come along who were less easy to dismiss?
That's exactly what's happened today. In fact, it started, I would say, about a decade and a half ago. That up until then, you could write these people off because it was the George Lincoln Rockwells, or it was even the David Dukes, but it was David Duke running around in his sheet and his cone head or whatever the costume is that he wore when he was Ku Klux Klan magician or wizard or whatever the name is. But what the deniers began to do in the late 70s is shed that cloak and don a cloak of pseudo-academic respectability. So they began to publish books. There's one professor of electrical engineering in Northwestern University who published a book denying the Holocaust, The Hoax of the 20th Century, it's called. And it has small margins and lots of footnotes and densely printed, and it looks terribly boring. So people think that, oh, this must be a serious book. And they began to run academic conferences or pseudo-academic conferences to publish a journal that looked like an academic journal, so much so that an undergraduate, an honors student at Yale who was studying history, when he saw the description of the journal, didn't see the journal itself, but saw the description of the journal in a bibliography of journals, sent them a paper he had written in one of his Yale classes because he thought, oh, this sounds like a respectable operation, and much to his mortification discovered that he was published in a denial journal. He was sent $250 by the deniers for the article, and I often say that should, if he had been more experienced, that would have been a clue to him that this wasn't an academic journal because academic journals don't pay and don't publish so quickly. But in any case, case, that's what they've been doing. They've been cloaking themselves in this aura of respectability, reason, dialogue, and it fools people.
If someone denying the Holocaust starts quoting texts from the movement that sound scholarly and that outsiders don't know is published by the movement, it sounds like, well, you've got evidence, don't you?
Exactly. What they engage in what has been described as a merry-go-round, a cross-fertilization of one quoting the other, quoting the other, quoting the other. Or they'll sponsor a study of gas chambers, which purports to be a serious scientific study, which of course is not. And then they'll quote it as proof, scientific proof that the Holocaust didn't happen. So you get this circular kind of one depending on the other.
There's someone named Austin J. App, who was an English professor at the University of Scranton and at LaSalle College, who in 1973 published a pamphlet called The 6 Million Swindle, Blackmailing the German People for Hard Marks with Fabricated Corpses. And it's this pamphlet, you say, that really outlined the basic principles of what became the Holocaust denial movement. What are some of those principles?
Some of those principles, A, that there was never a program by the Nazis to annihilate the Jews. That the Nazis never planned to, using the lingo of the Nazis, to exterminate the Jews. That the gas chambers were a fraud. That 6 million Jews never died. That many of those Jews are alive and well and living someplace else. And that this is all a Zionist plot. I think that connection to Israel, particularly in App's work, is very, very strong. That this is all a hoax in order for Jews to get a state and to get money.
Who is Austin App, who wrote the pamphlet?
He really was a nobody, you know. He was a professor, with all due respect to the University of Scranton and LaSalle. He was a relatively unknown professor of medieval English. I've met some of his students who found him sort of a stuffy type. But he had this sort of Walter Mitty existence on the side, where he wrote violently anti-Semitic letters to newspapers, to magazines, most of which weren't published, so he eventually published them himself, letters of Austin J. App, in which he accused Jews of trying to destroy Germany, trying to starve Germany out of existence, and being behind the program to completely ruin the rehabilitation of Germany. He was a great philo-German. He was an anti-Semite as well.
My guest is Deborah Lipstadt. She teaches modern Jewish and Holocaust studies at Emory University. She's the author of the new book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Deborah Lipstadt is my guest, author of the new book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. One of the recent points that the Holocaust revision movement is making is the gas chambers couldn't have been used for mass executions. Why are they focusing on that, do you think?
Because I think if they can cast doubt on the gas chambers, they feel they can cast doubt on the rest of it. Because it's the gas chambers that is one aspect of what makes the Holocaust unique. It's this use of modern scientific methods, not guns and not missiles and not scuds, all of which are horrible, but modern science used solely for the purpose of killing people. And if they can pull that out, then they can create doubt in people's minds.
I'm sure you've asked yourself a lot, why is there a group of people who are trying to deny that the Holocaust happened or are trying to downplay what happened during the Holocaust? What conclusions have you come to about that?
Well, I think there are a number of ways of trying to understand these people. Many of them, some of them are kooks and quacks, flat earth theorists. People, you know, one of them wrote a book, Hitler's Secret Weapon, UFOs, Unidentified Flying Objects, Hitler's Secret Weapon. They're, you know, so some of them really border on the gray area of rational thinking. Some of them are absolute burning anti-Semites. Some are neo-Nazis and philo-Germans. And some are conspiracy theorists, you know, who see a conspiracy all about. And some are a combination of all the above. Many of them are from the far right wing. Not only, but many are from the far right wing. And many of them have a white supremacist agenda.
You make an interesting point in your book that early on there were a lot of fascists who were in the Holocaust denial movement, and they wanted to disconnect fascism from the Holocaust because the Holocaust just made fascism seem really bad. So to cleanse the idea of fascism, they wanted to downplay or deny the Holocaust.
That's exactly one of the main points I'm trying to make, because while it happened early on, it's happening even more now. If the neo-Nazis and the fascists, or if we call them neo or Nazis and the fascists, but contemporary Nazis and fascists, if they can convince people that the Holocaust didn't happen, then what's so wrong with National Socialism? What's so wrong with Nazism? What's so wrong with fascism? And consequently, Holocaust denial has proven to be very alluring to a lot of extremist nationalists, even intellectuals or academics in the former Eastern Bloc countries, who are very much attracted by a strong-willed right-wing government, such as a National Socialist government, but who are repelled by the Holocaust. So if you can remove the Holocaust, then what's so wrong with National Socialism? After all, they bombed London, we bombed Cologne. They had camps, Buchenwald and Dachau, while we had camps for the Japanese-Americans. There's no comparison between the camps, the Japanese-American camps, which were horrible, but there's no comparing them in their horror to what Buchenwald and Dachau were all about. But they deal in immoral equivalencies. And the only immoral equivalency that they can't find a parallel for is the Holocaust. Let's get rid of that.
There's an institute that's one of the centers for the Holocaust denial movement called the Institute for Historical Research. You say that they're funded, at least in part, by the Liberty Lobby. What's the Liberty Lobby?
It's the Institute for Historical Review, the IHR, based in California. And the Liberty Lobby is one of the most far-right entities we have in this country. It publishes things like the Liberty Bell and the Spotlight, and a whole nexus, if not directly connected with them, indirectly connected, a far-right kind of publications. And they have had the same mailing address as the Institute for Historical Review, the same people right at the helm of one, at the helm of the other. So there's very little question about the connection between the two.
Has there been anyone who's written for one of the publications associated with the Holocaust denial movement who is pretty well known and we'd be surprised to hear that they
published? Yes, the person who's most surprising is David Irving, who is a very prominent, maybe unknown to Americans, but a very popular historical writer in England who has written Hitler's Secret War. He just wrote a book about Churchill. He writes books that sell a lot, historical works on World War II. He is a far right, politically connected with the far right, and he has become a denier. He used to be a fellow traveler. He has become a denier.
You've said that some of the people in the Holocaust denial movement are conspiracy theorists. Are there any connections between the Holocaust deniers and the conspiracy theorists who fixate on the Kennedy assassination?
Absolutely. There are quite a few people who are pretty prominent in the JFK conspiracy theory movement who are deniers or associated with the denial movement. The most prominent of them is Mark Lane, who was one of the earliest to talk about a conspiracy to cover up the killing of JFK, and who is the lawyer for the Institute, has served as the legal representative for the Institute for Historical Review and is closely connected with them. But there are others as well whose names wouldn't be known to us, but when you know denial literature, you see them in both places.
You see Holocaust revisionism as just like a case study in how people are trying to rewrite the past with what they're passing off as facts but are just lies. What are some of the other examples of that you see around now?
Well, I think there's an attempt to play with history of African Americans on both sides. There are those who argue that slavery was not so bad, there are others who argue that Afrocentrists who argue that while Africa hasn't gotten its rightful place, which I think they're right in many educational systems, argue that Africa is the cradle for all, everything that came out that's useful to society has come out of there. I think they're those kinds of revisionist views of history. I think there'll be others that'll come along. We see it in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We see it in lots of places. This attempt to attack history to rewrite history. History is the new battleground.
Why is history the new battleground? I mean, most Americans consider themselves to be totally uninterested in history. The word history is such a turnoff.
Right. People get bored the minute they hear, oh, that's history. In fact, you know, that's the greatest, one of the great put-downs is your history.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure, but I think that we've seen, this attack on history connects with something else, with another intellectual movement, which was very popular the past 10 years, and that's deconstructionism. And I don't mean this to be an attack on deconstructionism, but what deconstructionism argued is that a text has no set meaning. It's the interpretation that the reader brings to the text. And deconstructionism has something to recommend it. It says that voices such as women's voices or people of color voices weren't heard in interpretation of text. But then when people who really didn't understand the movement got a hold of it, and even some who did understand it, and took it to its lowest common denominator, what happened was there's an inability to say, this is nonsense. There's an inability to say, this makes no sense, or this is wrong. It sort of backed into or came in confluence with a moral relativism that has permeated much of American life, starting in academic circles and moving out. It's a fuzzy kind of reasoning, which I find very frightening.
Do you think history has become the new battleground in part because in our search for identity, for roots, for our historical place, our personal historical place in the world, history has become a tool more than it ever has, I think, in American popular culture for giving us a personal identity?
Absolutely. I think people want an anchor. And I think one of the anchors is history. And if the history doesn't exist, I'll make it up. If the history isn't there, I'll adopt it and adapt it to make it my own. And it makes it it's a very fragile instrument. Memory is a very fragile thing. And that's why I think places like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum are so important, because it's a historical museum that shows the history of National Socialism and the destruction of so many human beings, Jews and non-Jews.
So by manipulating history, you're also manipulating identity.
Absolutely. You're playing with people's identity. And part of, if people don't have an identity and they want to create it, they rewrite history in order to have that identity. But I think the important thing, going back to the actual Holocaust deniers, is that they're also trying to, they have the anti-Semitic agenda, they have the neo-Nazi agenda, and they have an anti-Israel agenda, and they have this sort of conspiracy theory agenda, and they have found that history is the right vehicle to try to advance those agendas.
Deborah Lipstadt is the author of Denying the Holocaust. She's a professor of Modern Jewish and Holocaust Studies at Emory University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.